Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Barbara Mikulski has been a social worker, a community organizer, a Baltimore City Council member, a congresswoman for 10 years, and for the last 30 years, she's been Senator Barb. By the time she retired in January as the longest-serving woman in the history of the U.S. Congress, Senator Mikulski had earned a reputation as a fierce advocate for families, women, children, seniors, and scientists. She's also earned the respect of her colleagues on both sides of the aisle, mentoring and helping to pave the way for other women seeking elective office. Senator Barbara Mikulski is my guest for the hour today. We'll talk about her remarkable career, her take on Trump, and her prescriptions for the Democrats as they navigate the vagaries of Washington without her. Senator Barb, coming up on Midday, right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. Very glad that you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Maryland's former Senator Barbara Mikulski. She retired in January after a record-setting career as the longest-serving woman in the history of the U.S. Congress, the longest-serving state politician in the history of Maryland, and one of the most beloved and popular public figures in our state and throughout the country. She is the only Democratic woman to serve in the United States Senate who wasn't appointed. She didn't wind up there because she was filling the term of a deceased husband. She got there the old-fashioned way, although a way that wasn't in fashion at the time. She got to the Senate in 1986 the way she got to the Baltimore City Council in 1971 and the U.S. Congress in 1976. She was elected time and time again as a tenacious advocate and a fearless fighter. In addition to a rich legislative legacy, she also leaves a legacy of trailblazing for other women in politics. When she became a senator, she was one of only two women in the upper chamber. The other was Republican Senator Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas. When she left the Senate in January, there were 21 women, many of whom Barbara Mikulski helped get elected and whom she mentored as their careers developed. She is a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, awarded to her by President Obama last November. She is currently serving as Homewood Professor of Public Policy and advisor to the President at Johns Hopkins University. Most folks know her as Senator Barb. She joins me today in Studio A, and the first segment of today's show is being streamed on Facebook Live. Senator, it's good to see you.
Good morning, and I'm happy to be on the radio and talking with you and going to take listener calls. I'm excited
about that. Yep, we are. We're going to do that in 15 minutes or so, and I'm glad that we are streaming this so that folks can see how good you look, but you're feeling well, and you're adjusting to the new rhythm. It's a different rhythm than being a senator, isn't it?
Well, it is a very different rhythm. You know, every day I used to get up and commute into Washington, and the first day I could wake up, drink coffee, and be 10 minutes away, it was goodbye to tension, hello to Homewood. I loved it. I loved it. And that's what so many people are facing. It's harder and harder to get to work. This is why we really need infrastructure in this. We've got a lot of policy to talk about.
We do, indeed.
Beside me.
One of the things I want to talk about first is you and I have a mutual friend, Sister Connie Fitzgerald, who is a Carmelite nun
Yes.
up at the monastery up on Delaney Valley Road. And you and I happened to be at the same event that Sister Connie did with a Jesuit priest named Father McDermott, Brian McDermott, about a year and a half ago. And they gave a day-long presentation about the differences or the similarities between the Carmelite and the Ignatian approach to prayer. The Carmelite sort of patron saint is Sister Teresa of Avila, and the Jesuit patron, of course, Saint Ignatius. And they talked, and Sister Connie, who's a great scholar and a terrific person, talked about the difference between discursive prayer and contemplative prayer, where you pray asking God for something directly, you know, please help me get a job, please help my aunt recover from cancer, or contemplative prayer where you're just listening and being open to the presence of God. The public discourse, as your career progressed over the 45-plus years you were in politics, seems to have gotten more and more coarse and vitriolic and bifurcated. One of the things you're beloved for is setting up these bipartisan dinners with the other women in Congress. And it seems to me that that might have been one of the few places, the few venues that public officials had to listen to each other in something approaching a contemplative way. How do we get our politics back to the point where people are no longer just talking and pronouncing, but they're listening?
Well, first of all, what an amazing lead into the radio conversation that we're going to have, talking about that marvelous program at the Carmelites, where they were celebrating their over 100th anniversary. They really got started in Maryland, down in Southern Maryland,
right.
And of course up here, and have had such a tremendous influence. But there was one really the talking about how we talk to God, and then the other form is how we be sure that we ponder for God to listen to us. And I would encourage people, particularly while we're still in this Lenten season, for those of the Christian faith, to continue to ponder these things. But I'll tell you something. It is listening. And anybody who's good in elective office learns to listen. But what happened in the 90s, it really was a rocking and rolling time. We had Gingrich heading up the House of Representatives. He brought a different style, a bombastic style, very different than Tip O'Neill and very different than even Republican leaders. However, over in the Senate, after the Anita Hill debacle, remember how awful Anita Hill was, humiliated before the United States Senate.
And the Clarence Thomas hearings.
Yes, the Clarence Thomas hearings and so on. We had the so-called Year of the Woman. Well, I never liked that because it was like the Year of the Asparagus, the Year of the Mushroom. We were going to get our own year.
That was 1992. That was a long
but
time ago.
New women came to the Senate, and one was a Republican woman for Texas, and she reached out to me on an idea for the economic empowerment of women. Now, the first point I'm going to make is judge not. My staff said, ew, why do you want to work with Kay Bailey Hutchinson? She's a conservative Republican from Texas. Her staff was saying, oh, my God, what do you want to do, Mikulski, liberal firebrand from the East Coast? Well, we worked together, and we went out to dinner. We had such a good time getting to know each other. And after that, we said, how about inviting the other women? That became the very, very firmest monthly dinners of the women of the Senate, started 25 years ago, still going on now, not to be a caucus, but to be a zone of civility and to find not only common ground, but as Elijah Cummings says, higher ground. And we've worked on women's health, women's economic empowerment, and also tried to help women around the world.
And the rules were no press, no staff, no notes, right?
No press, no leaks, no memos,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. When you see things like Senator Warren, a woman who you've helped mentor a bit, being censured in the Senate a month or two ago, the so-called Rule 19, when she tried to, you know, simply put on the record a letter from Coretta Scott King. It seems like, as one person in the Los Angeles Times put it, it seems like solving the nation's problems has gone out of fashion, and we're just—it's all this political gamesmanship. When something like that happens, what's your response? How should we?
Well, when I saw what happened to Senator Warren, I really became enormously agitated. Because I know about Rule 19. It was established many years ago when senators would come to the floor and refer to each other in either vile or vulgar terms, or even got into fights. Rule 19 came because they'd gotten into fist fights on the Senate floor. So because Elizabeth Warren had risen, and remember, to shut her up, they were really attacking two women. They were attacking Senator Warren and, by implication, also Coretta King. So it was a misuse of the rule, and it said, well, it's because she persisted. Well, you darn right she persisted. And that's really the way it's going to be. Don't use the rules inappropriately. And I think people are tired of that. What they want us to be doing is listening to them, their real day-to-day problems. What does that mean in terms of public policy and how we can help them in a smart, effective, cost-effective way?
You were the first candidate back in 1986 to be backed by Emily's List, which is an organization advocating for women in elective office. There are reports that there are more than 13,000 women now planning to run for elective office, particularly following the march, the Women's March, the day after the inauguration in January. But in this last election, not only did Secretary Clinton not win that election, but women candidates were still under about 25% of winners in more than 7,400 or about 7,400 legislative seats around the country. What are the barriers and the fact that we have so many people evidently planning to run for office? Do you think that we are about to overcome those barriers and enter some sort of halcyon age for women in politics?
Well, I think it's also access to money to run. In other words, the higher the office or to go, say, from city council, Congress, to the Senate, which I did. City council was grassroots. I got into politics because we were fighting the highway in Fells Point. We were that where they wanted to put a 16-lane highway through Fells Point. And we also hadn't had any new government services like a library, a public school, et cetera, in years. And it was all about the political bosses. Same in West Side, the Rosemont neighborhood. And by the way, we formed the first interracial citywide coalition. However, it was sweat equity. It was going door to door. It was putting together volunteers. When you run statewide, I say every woman needs a mom. You need a message on what you want to do, the organization to do it, and the money to do it. And I think raising money is an enormous barrier for women and anybody who comes out of a grassroots group. So my advice now is start grassroots, run for that city council. Wow, look at the big number of people who ran for city council here. And look,
and we
at
have
the,
eight new members.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
Several
terrific.
Of whom are women. Yeah, sure.
Yes, terrific. So for the women who want to get started, we need a pipeline. We need a farm team. Run for city council or local government or state rep. We have an election coming up in 2018. And get out there and do it.
On the national scene, people have said that the bench for Democrats is a little weak. People are talking about Senator Warren. They're talking about Senator Schumer, Senator Booker, perhaps. Who do you see as the new leadership, either person or persons, in the National Democratic Party?
So when you say bench weak, are you talking about who will be the possible presidential candidates?
Yeah, and
in 2020?
And as well as who you think, now that President Obama is no longer in office, who is the at least the putative head of the party?
I believe that there should be many voices. I believe that trying to look for a single figurehead in terms of a national party, we need many voices, and we need to listen to each other. We are an enormously diverse country. And we have to have, first of all, leadership that tries to bring us together. That's respect. That's listening. That's civility. And I think we have a tremendous talent of people in the Congress that are doing this. Where I think we are thin is what happened to us in the governor's races, which is also the farm team or the pipeline for the presidential race. We have very good Democratic governors. But I think we need to also look in that area as well.
Is there what can, and people have even placed some of the blame for that on President Obama. We lost, the Democrats lost, you know, nearly 1,000 state legislative seats during his 8 years in office. Are there things that you think the president could have done and that we or you as a Democrat, part of the Democratic establishment should do in these next 2 years, 4 years, 6 years to reverse that?
Well, it's not only the who, but it's the what. Let's go back to this election. This was an incredible election. It was testy. People who would have ever thought we would follow in the direction that we did. I think people, it's not only the who's, I think people are tired of the testiness. I think they're tired of toxic debate. I think they're tired of temper tantrums rather than discussions. And I think people want us to listen again to their issues and what does it mean to public policy. We've got to, I mean, it was very loud and clear, the people who voted for Trump, they wanted to be listened to and they wanted to be respected. And they felt that they were not. Now, we have to take that into consideration. How do you get out and talk with the people? Now, some of it is disappointing. First of all, I'll tell you, when Twitter came in, I was really excited about Twitter. I thought I could microblog to my constituents. Love that idea. And then also, unfiltered commentary to me. What I saw happen, though, on Twitter was the responses were both violent and vulgar. We've got to look at the coarsening of debate in our society and move, and that's also part of the larger culture. But most of all, we got to listen to the people. And the first thing we need to listen to, where are the jobs today and where are the jobs tomorrow?
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, President Trump has issued a flurry of executive orders in his first 60 days, and one of them, issued last month, had to do with historically black colleges and universities. President of Morgan State University, David Wilson, was part of an Oval Office meeting of black education leaders that many have said was nothing more than a photo op. And even that was overshadowed by a photo taken that day of senior advisor Kellyanne Conway sitting cross-legged on an Oval Office couch. So President Wilson will join me to talk about issues facing HBCUs and what, if anything, the executive order will accomplish. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday, along with a conversation about mentoring with Kara Ritter, the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Greater Chesapeake. My guest for the hour today is one of the most influential mentors in the history of American politics. Barbara Mikulski represented Maryland in the United States Senate for 30 years. We'll have more with Senator Mikulski when we return from a break, and we will begin taking your calls, your questions, and your comments for Senator Barb. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. More with Senator Mikulski when we return. Stick around.
What a bloodless way to talk about such a important public policy issue. To simply get a bill on the Senate floor, we have to vote on a motion to proceed on whether we're going to take it up. And because this is now going to require a 60-vote majority because of the invocation of this fog of filibuster, we can't even get to a majority vote on how to make sure women get equal pay for equal work. No wonder people are fed up with us. They wonder about us why, when all is said and done, why more gets said than gets done. I travel in the state of Maryland and the United States of America. People want us to do our job, to work on a bipartisan basis, hands across the aisle, work across the dome to solve national problems.
Senator Barbara Mikulski speaking on the floor of the Senate in April of 2014 about a vote just to begin the debate on the Paycheck Fairness Act. That was legislation that she introduced to help close the wage gap between women and men who work in equivalent jobs. And by the way, that bill never made it into law despite repeated attempts by Senator Mikulski during the following 2 years. Senator Barbara Mikulski is joining us for this hour of Midday. Last January, she retired after more than four decades of public service. She's now Homewood Professor of Public Policy and Advisor to the President at Johns Hopkins University. You are welcome to join us with questions for the Senator. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Senator, this was, 3 years ago, you were on the floor, and it's not the first and only time that you railed against this lack of productive discussion and productive work on behalf of people. People's cynicism about Congress perhaps has never been higher. People's distrust, and now that distrust perhaps is going very, very much in display of even the executive branch. Where do you think this is headed, and how can this course that seems to be sort of inalterably directed towards more divisiveness, how can it be changed so that the country starts coming together?
Well, the people have to demand it, and demand, again, number one, that we do our job. Number two, that we don't use the fog of rules, floating rules, to be able to get the job done. I say floating rules because, first of all, we believe in our country majority rules. So before in the United States Senate, it was the majority vote. Rarely would we invoke a filibuster, which would take a 60-vote majority to deal with it. Well, now, during the last 2 years of the Obama administration, the Republicans, and I would say the right-wing Republicans, not the moderate ones looking to find some sensible compromise, would invoke the filibuster every day. And that's why I used the phrase the fog of filibuster and the rules. So people are fed up. They want to have straightforward debate. They want to be able to understand it. They don't want us to hide behind arcane rules or an arcane vocabulary. They want us to stand up and vote, and then you know our record, and you can decide whether you want to keep us or look somewhere else. And I think that's what we need to get back to. People want straight talk. They want plain English. They want problem solving. Though we are obsessed with politics right now, they really want us to be obsessed with solving problems that also don't lay the cost on the back of the American people.
Senator Schumer and others have suggested, for example, a filibuster as a strategy concerning the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. What do you think of that idea?
I'm not opposed to the use of a filibuster, but the filibuster should be judicious. It should be used in rare circumstances for big national issues on a particular person. Where we are now is we're playing tick for tack, tick for tack, tick. In the meantime, the clock is ticking. And I want to make sure that we all agree that we want the United States to continue to be the land of opportunity, the home of the free, and where we recognize the brave, whether our military, our firefighters, or others who protect us.
We have a call from Tom in Mount Vernon. Tom, welcome to Midday. You're on the phone with Senator Mikulski.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And Senator Mikulski, I can't describe exactly how proud I am personally of you. But and it's so good to hear a Baltimore accent. I have a question, Senator.
Yes.
The correct pronunciation of Baltimore, is it Baltimore, Baltimore, or Ballmer?
Now you're being asked a diction and linguistic question.
Now we're getting into very sensitive things. Why don't we talk about something easy like healthcare reform? Your question could only be the most controversial question is, where is the best crab cake? But picking it up, you know, I grew up in East Baltimore. I'm a Highland Town woman, or as we said, Holland Town. And I would say, you can say Baltimore. Make sure you use the T, Baltimore. But we who are indigenous people here will say Baltimore or Balmer.
There you go, Tom. You've gotten some straight talking from one of the most straight talking
politicians.
But no
matter how you pronounce it, live it and be proud of it.
And you have indeed spent your life here. And now in your new, this next chapter, post-Senate, you're at Hopkins and you're very much involved in a lot of things going on here in the city. You're working on a project with the Enoch Pratt Library. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when you leave this United States Senate, you have what you call your papers, the memos, the policy thinking behind what you did and how you voted, whether that was on a woman's health agenda or your thinking when you had to vote on the Iraq War. So that belongs to scholars, and that is at the Sheridan Library At the Enoch Pratt. But I have other things, historic pictures.
The Sheridan Library is actually on the campus of Hopkins,
right? The Sheridan Library is on the campus of Johns Hopkins, and it will be primarily for scholars and so on. And it's not a general public library. But there are things that I have and things that I did and things that I was recognized with that really belong to a much larger audience. And so I have historic photographs and memorabilia, which I'm giving to the Enoch Pratt. And one of the things that I will place on a long-term loan to them for public display is my Medal of Freedom. Now, when President Obama...
So that'll be at the Pratt.
Yes. When President Obama presented me with the Medal of Freedom, this medal, yes, it was given to me. But it was given to me because of the work that I did. And the work that I did, I could do it because of the people who voted for me, the people who talked with me, who came to roundtables, wrote me letters, and so on. And so I wanted to, and it will be in a room. We're talking to the Pratt now. They're going to go wild that I'm even talking about this on the radio, where it will be also used for adult literacy, because it's not only about the past. You know, I've met with a lot of firsties, Tom. Sally Ride, Sandra Day O'Connor, those of us who were the first. And one of the things we say we have in common is behind a me, there's a whole lot of we, and one of which is public institutions. So public schools, private libraries. So I wanted to make available things that were in my life but were there that really belong to the people. They should see it. They should know what it looks like, and also promote literacy, and that it really belongs to the people.
Senator Barbara Mikulski is my guest here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So now that you've solved the most pressing problem, which is how to pronounce Baltimore, let me give you a softball. What do you think is going to happen with the American Health Care Act, which is perhaps going to be voted on as early as tomorrow? This is the Republican answer to Obamacare.
Well, this is really an issue of enormous consequence, enormous to people who need health care and want to have access to health care and access to affordable health care. The Republican approach was to repeal and to replace. Well, they're going to try to repeal, but there's nothing about what they're replacing with it that is a workable solution. I personally hope that it's voted down and we come back to a more sensible approach. And the reason so, and it goes to not just what Barb Mikulski thinks, it's what Dr. Lena Wynn, who is our public health
city commissioner. Health commissioner here in Baltimore.
Oh, she's just fantastic. And she has talked about how it will deny coverage. First of all, millions of people will lose coverage. Second,
estimate by this Congressional Budget Office, about 24 million people.
About 24 million people. The other is by what they want to do on Medicaid, because people think, oh, well, you know, that's the unworthy. They should be working. They shouldn't be doing this. 80% of the beneficiaries of Medicaid are children. But 80% of the money is for seniors, primarily in nursing homes. Really, in this country, we don't want to pit children against old people. Why should a child with asthma and that child's needs be pitted against a family whose father has Alzheimer's, like my dear father passed away from the consequences? So I think that it is a misguided approach. There's no doubt, that there was parts of Obamacare that needed to be reviewed and repaired.
Were there any conversations over these past 7 years, 8 years of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare? I mean, they voted to repeal it many, many times. But were there – they had 7 or 8 years, it seems, to come up with a plan to fix it or to revise it. Were there any conversations that you had with your colleagues in the Senate and the Congress about perhaps ways to tweak this thing and make it work? Or did they just we had this slogan of repeal and replace, and then they got their chance to do it, and now we're seeing that there's a number of Republicans, including Republican governors, who oppose what they're suggesting.
We were dug in. They would offer the repeal. They did not offer the replace. This is the first time that they've offered a replace, and the replace really is deficient. Because I think it's going to cause great harm to seniors. I think premiums are going to continue to go up. And where I wished we had focused and tried to find, again, common ground was on the high cost of prescription drugs. As I move around our community even now, one of the things that weighs heaviest on people's minds is can they afford the prescription drug that their doctor has prescribed for, like for their child, or for themselves or whatever. And we've got to do something about that.
The investigation that FBI Director Comey alluded to in his testimony before the Intelligence Committee on Monday revealed that there has been an ongoing probe into connections between people in the Trump campaign and Russian operatives. This investigation appears to have begun in the summer, sometime in July or August. Does it strike you as interesting that Director Comey talked about an investigation into Secretary Clinton's emails with 2 or 3 weeks left in the election, and no mention was ever made of the fact that they were, in fact, looking into what was going on in the Trump campaign?
Well, first of all, books will be written about what Comey did that affected Hillary when he announced that ongoing effort at the email investigation. But where we are now is startling. Now, I was a member of the Intelligence Committee, and it was a great honor, and it was an enormous responsibility. Rupersberger was also a member in the House. Mm-hmm. Senator Cardin, because of being on the Foreign Relations Committee, would also receive classified briefings, as would Steny, because he was in leadership.
Steny Hoyer.
Yes, Congressman Hoyer. Uh-huh. Now, one of the things that was clear during the summer was there was grave concern among the intelligence community, not one agency, but about Russian attempts to interfere in our elections. This is startling. This is shocking. This is unacceptable. This is, you know, and it was clear that the new battle space is cyberspace. And we talked about it. We looked at it. We took steps. I know that Governor Hogan was very conscientious in terms of making sure of the integrity of the electoral process in Maryland. To make sure we were cyberproof and tampering-proof, and he should be recognized along with the Board of Elections. Not that there weren't mistakes, but it wasn't because of the Russians. So one is the Russian attempt to do that. Then there's second, but that's a different issue than Trump colluding or Trump campaign operatives colluding. Did they collude? Was it a secret collusion, meaning that Mr. Trump didn't know about it? Did Mr. Trump direct it? And then there is this whole issue of Trump, the Russians, and the oligarchs, and what else has been engaged with. So there is
a big story in the AP just this morning about Paul Manafort and his work for a Russian billionaire who's associated with Vladimir Putin.
Well, I'll tell you, I think every day about Bethlehem Steel is very much on my mind. And I know that there's a great effort now underway at the state and local level with Kevin Kamenetz and the governor and so on the revitalization of Sparrows Point. But there are two things. One, Wilbur Ross, our now Secretary of Commerce. And Wilbur Ross headed up a hedge fund that really stripped Bethlehem Steel of its assets. If I were still in the Senate, I could not have waited to vote against Wilbur Ross because he stands for everything American business should not, to gouge employees. But what became worse than Wilbur was the oligarch. The Russians then, a Russian oligarch owned Bethlehem Steel, a 32-year-old billionaire because he was a Putin teacher's pet. That's how you get to be a billionaire. Now, we can't have people doing business interests with Russian oligarchs. It doesn't work out well for the people in our country, and it doesn't work out well for the national security interest. Comey's doing an investigation. I think Congress is doing its job. You're shaking your head. But this is, I cannot tell you, this is one of the most crucial public policy issues.
And do you think
issues.
That's going to be enough, or should the Justice Department appoint a special prosecutor?
You get to a special prosecutor if you think a criminal law has been violated. We're not there yet. And I must say, from what I know of what's going on with the intelligence committees and both houses, that there is a sincere effort to get to this, and where necessary, then it should go even higher.
Senator Barbara Mikulski joins me today in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Back in 1966, plans were laid for a highway straight through some of Baltimore's most diverse neighborhoods. The new road seemed like a go. It was about to happen, that is, until it ran into a young social worker. And let's just say you don't want to be on the wrong side of Barbara Mikulski. She stopped that highway and jump-started one of the finest public service careers we've ever seen. And for decades, Barbara has been a lioness, on Capitol Hill, fighting for working families, fighting for high-tech, high-paying jobs, fighting for the prospects of America's women and girls.
President Barack Obama, speaking at the ceremony in 2015 in which he awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to my guest today, former United States Senator Barbara Mikulski. She represented Maryland in the Senate for 30 years, and before that, she represented Maryland's 3rd Congressional District for 10 years. She began her political career as a community activist in the late 1960s. As the president alluded to, she organized opposition to a proposed extension of I-70 that would have run a 16-lane highway right through Fells Point in southeast Baltimore. So the next time you're down in Fells Point having a drink, thanks Senator Mikulski that you don't have to cross a 16-lane highway. She was first elected to the Baltimore City Council back in 1971. She retired from the Senate a couple of months ago, and she's now a Homewood Professor of Public Policy and advisor to the president at Johns Hopkins University. If you have a question for Senator Mikulski, you are welcome to give us a call. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Well, Senator, as you can imagine, there are a bunch of folks who'd like to say hi. Let's start with Carmen in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Senator Mikulski.
Hi.
Hi, Carmen. What's on your mind?
First of all, I want to thank Senator Barbara Mikulski. I came to Baltimore in 71 to go to school, and I've been involved in politics. I've worked for Ed Koch, and, well, anyway, I'm very nervous. But what I want to ask Senator Mikulski is, what you're saying is true. We have to get out to vote, get more women, men, more people with democratic values to be in politics. But in the meanwhile, Trump is president, and he is not a democratic-thinking person. He has Nazis and Steve Bannon. I mean, I'm afraid that we don't have the time to wait 2 years. There is a connection. He's not a person who thinks for himself. I mean, he's a child.
Well, Carmen, I think we got the gist of your comment, Senator. There is a crisis, it seems, in many people's fundamental trust of this president. Can we believe anything the president says?
Well, first of all, we could focus on the personality, and I can understand what Carmen just talked about. Number one, though, we have to go back that we are a nation of laws and not only a nation of personalities. And the greatest thing we have going for ourselves is the Constitution. And the Constitution and the founders, along with good advice from the founding mothers, also put in checks and balances, which is Trump can't do everything. He has a Congress to deal with. And we also have the courts. That's why we need an independent judiciary. That's what really is the focus of the Gorsuch hearings. Is he his own man? And therefore, you can look to his writings, his thinking, and so on, et cetera. So I think, though, what we have to remember is we go back to the Constitution. We focus on what are the policies that Trump is trying to advocate. And I guess the biggest surprise for me was not only the credibility issue that Carmen has raised, but he's not functioning as a businessman. A businessman, and my dad had a small grocery store, is a business person always goes for the best people around them. Well, he doesn't have picked any. There are very few people in the cabinet that have the qualifications to do the job. And the second thing is every business person asked, what is the cost? What is the cost-benefit analysis? And when you look at what Trump wants to do, it does not add up. He promised jobs today and jobs tomorrow to a lot of people, and they're really dependent on him. So what is he going to do? Because of his policies, he won't be able to afford to do infrastructure. The latest budget that he proposed cuts out the very money to do infrastructure funding in transportation, building at the local community. And he also cut out the money for the jobs tomorrow, the research, like in the NIH. $5 billion cutting, what, to give a tax break to a billionaire?
What then should be the Democratic opposition strategy? I mean, the Republicans during the Obama administration became known as the party of no. Should the Democrats be the party of no when it comes to Mr. Trump and things like health care and job creation, the budget, immigration reform?
I think that, first of all, you have to be the party of no on ideas that really are unworkable and unaffordable, one of which is the wall. The wall won't keep out necessarily the illegal things. He's focusing on illegal people. I focused on illegal drugs coming into this country and also the blight and awfulness of human trafficking. What we need is to be focusing on what creates jobs today. Now, when he talked about infrastructure, that could have been a common ground. There's not one senator, one member of the House of Representatives that doesn't have needs in their own community. Let's take Baltimore. Baltimore is under a consent decree to rebuild its water supply. It was done. All those pipes are over 100 years old. How about the Howard?
The consent decree is like 12 years old. Yeah.
Yes. And so that in of itself, $2 billion. The Howard Street Tunnel. Now, if we talked with engineers, the B&O Railroad, they've come up with new techniques where it would have been cheaper and safer, not disturbing Bolton Hill, no more fear about toxic explosions in the tunnel. And look what it would do for commerce up and down the corridor. So this is where, and look at the people who would go to work, from the engineers to the people who would do the heavy lifting. We need jobs, and we have to look at jobs tomorrow. Life science, energy, others that could create jobs.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to be in the current budget outline that the president has
proposed.
Well,
that's where you have to resist. But I believe that in the institution, there's bipartisan support. I worked with a guy from Pennsylvania, Senator Arlen Specter. He and I and others worked to double the funding at NIH. Look what we did. And, you know, you can compromise without capitulating on principle, but we found what were the things we could work on. So I think resisting should be strategic. Where it's absolutely wrong or going to lead to greater harm to our country, we have to resist.
Just have a few minutes left. Lauren in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Let's have a quick question for Senator Barbara Mikulski.
Hi, Senator Mikulski. I'm a big fan. However, and a Democrat for 30 years until actually recently, and that is because of what you were talking about with the Russia hacking. That initially came out because of the DNC email leaks, which everyone seems to ignore. And we have a young generation that is very well aware of it. And I guess what you're accusing the Russians of interfering in the election, however, our own Democratic Party did against Bernie Sanders. And that's pretty, I thought that was more shocking. I would hold my Democratic Party to a higher standard than the Russians.
Right.
I would
Thank
expect
you, Lauren.
Them to try to have.
I appreciate your comment. So is the experience of this election going to occasion a little soul searching on the part of the Democratic Party?
I wouldn't equate the DNC tussle with my very dear friend Senator Sanders with Russians trying to do this. And by the way, the Russians are tried to do it with us in this election, and there is indication, I don't have verification, but indication that they're trying to do this with other democratic countries in Europe. So I wouldn't equate the two. But look at what we're talking about here. We're talking about the dysfunction and attack on our electoral process. And the best watchdogs, I think, are also at the local level. You know, we need elected officials at the local level doing their job and then insisting also that everybody else follows the Constitution.
Let me try to sneak in at least one more call. Christina in Sparks, welcome to Midday with Senator Barb.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you, Barbara. I've written you many a time, and I really appreciate all that you've done over the years. My question is, what more, other than voting in 2 years, what more can individuals do now to lessen the negative impact of Trump's policies? What can I do and have my friends do?
Well, I believe in civic engagement as well as political participation. So we can have a railroad track, two rails to progress. In civic engagement, being involved at the local level in a cause or an issue or a program you believe in, whether it's Girl Scouts, whether it's literacy, whether it's Habitat for Humanity, get involved in something where at the end of the day or the end of the week, our community is in a better place.
Yeah, don't think of it in terms of what can I do. Or think of it in terms of what can I and my neighbors, my colleagues, my friends do. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
What about the Electoral College? A lot of folks after this last election said we should abolish it. Secretary Clinton even talked about her concerns about it, not just in this election, but in the 2008 election. What's your stand on that?
Well, the question, I think that's a debate really for scholars and for others to have a debate on. In order to change the Electoral College, you would need a constitutional amendment. And the minute we get into tampering with the Constitution right now, I'm not real excited about that prospect.
Senator, it has been a pleasure to see you. You look great. I'm delighted that we got to spend this time together. And
Well, I'm doing a lot more walking. I've got a Fitbit.
A Fitbit.
I got a Fitbit, but that doesn't mean that there won't be sightings for me. I still am a diner Democrat. I never met a calorie I didn't like or a hand I didn't want to shake.
Well, thank you for liking us enough to come by for the hour today. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
God bless you and God bless America.
Senator Barbara Mikulski is a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the longest serving woman in congressional history. She's currently serving on the faculty of Johns Hopkins, where she's a Homewood Professor of Public Policy and an advisor to the president of Johns Hopkins. Tomorrow on Midday, conversation about historically black colleges and universities with Dr. David Wilson, the president of Morgan State University, Jarrett Carter of the HBCU Digest, and Johnny Taylor. He's the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. President Trump issued an executive order moving oversight of HBCUs away from the Education Department and into the White House. We'll talk about what that might mean for the future of historically black schools. Plus, we'll have a conversation about the importance of mentoring with Kara Ritter of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake. Lunch for Midday today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. There's a calorie it'll be tough to walk past. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. So we'll see, Senator, if you and I can both resist that temptation. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.